This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything I and a surprisingly chipper Tom have been doing Monday, July the 12th, the morning after the Euros final. He looked a lot better than I expected him to. Right, what have we been doing? Well, we've had a big focus on travel after the government came out and announced the e-dates for the federal sector and the private sector generally these days following suit. 4 days off, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. What does that mean for travel patterns? We've been speaking to Emily Jenkins of Donata Travel. We've also been speaking to the global head of tourism and travel at the consultancy PwC, Nicholas Meyer, to get both the local and the international outlook. We've been looking at Richard Branson, Sir Richard Branson's journey into space and the regulations thereof with the guys from Kaspersky. Plus, Serena Kelly has been in with all the latest COVID news.
Ask Serena.
Morning, Serena.
Morning, guys.
Right, let's kick off looking at case and vaccine numbers.
So this time last week, you were looking at figures of 1,599 new cases. Yesterday, they announced after more than 280,700 tests, 1,518 new cases of COVID-19. It's been a steady drop in regards to every day the new cases have been announced the last couple of weeks. It's been a positive. They've been dropping. But the active cases are still going up purely because your recoveries are still considerably low in comparison to the figures that we've had in the past. 1,490 recoveries announced yesterday, 6 fatalities, so we're at a total of 1,866 deaths in the country. Active cases currently at 20,064, but we have crossed more than 650,000 reported cases in the UAE as well. When it comes to vaccine distribution, more than 15.9 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across the country so far. You had more than 18,400 doses administered in a 24-hour period on Saturday. Currently, more than 65% of the UAE population is now fully vaccinated. Latest percentage figures for you, 75.6% of the population have received one dose, while 65.8% of the population have had two. And that's the latest figures shared by NSEMA.
Right, let's have a look at what's happening in Asia. Just looking at the latest news coming out of Vietnam, where the health ministry has said that the country's COVID case numbers have risen tenfold since late April. So that's what, two and a half months.
And you've also got Tokyo. They're entering their fresh state of emergency today. It's due to last until August 22nd. So that's just before the Paralympics are due to begin. So the games themselves, the Olympic Games due to start July 23rd, running till August 8th. But Tokyo's state of emergency will be in place until August 22nd. Of course, we're aware organisers last week announced spectators would not be allowed. They will be banned from nearly all venues. Officials are now asking residents to watch on telly from the safety of their homes. It's Tokyo's fourth state of emergency. And then off the back of winning Wimbledon, you've had Novak Djokovic already say he's 50-50 about competing at the Olympics. The likes of Rafael Nadal, Dominic Thiem, Stan Wawrinka, Nick Kyrgios, Serena Williams, Simona Halep, they've all already announced decisions to skip the games. But when it comes to vaccine rollout in the country, about 28% of the population has received at least one shot. Tokyo recorded more than 600 new cases on Sunday.
Tom, would not most of the athletes already be there in Japan? Well, at what point do you turn up and start? I mean, I know there's been quite a lot of controversy about what would normally be the sort of the goodwill tours and stuff that would go on with kids and schools and everything have been cancelled. A lot of the acclimatisation camps aren't happening. So what kind of time frame are we talking?
So it depends on your sport, really. I mean, with the athletes, there's a lot of national trials still going on. There's a lot of camps still going on. They're still finalising teams, etc. So they will be one of the last to arrive. It sort of depends on the sport you're in, the acclimatisation you need. You'd think that a lot of the equestrian teams would be there because obviously their horses would have to be quarantining. So, yeah, I think a lot of it will be factored into the amount of quarantine you have to do, the amount of isolation you have to do, and your particular sport. But I think most, whereas a lot of nations would ordinarily send their teams well in advance for orientation, for acclimatization, for a bit of a laugh, you know, make the most of it, make the most of the moment, make the most of the experience. This year's a bit different because what you're going to do, you're going to send your athlete to sit in a hotel room or sit in their accommodation room. That's it. We talked yesterday about the mental health aspects of this games. So they will leave it till the last moment possible.
Let's look at Australia, Serena, where we have the highest case numbers in a year.
Yeah, Australia today reported its biggest daily rise in COVID-19 cases, as you said, Brandy, this year. Due to the Delta variant's presence in Sydney, currently in lockdown, which is due supposedly to end on Friday, but officials say that could be extended. The state of New South Wales reported 112 new locally transmitted cases, almost all of them in Sydney. It's marking the fifth consecutive day of record case numbers. But Australia's has had fairly low figures, more than 31,000 reported cases and over 900 fatalities since the pandemic began. But when it comes to their vaccine rollout, only around 11% of Australia's adult population of just over 20.5 million have been fully vaccinated so far. So that's playing hand in hand with the Delta variant as well.
Yeah, which, as Australians will know, is the source of some controversy at home. There's just been a very controversial new sort of scare campaign, ad campaign that rolled out in the last couple of days, warning you of, you know, basically saying get a vaccine. With a woman on a ventilator, it was quite
graphic.
Yeah, scary. And people sort of saying, well, I would, but my appointment. And again, there's a bit of, you know, which appointment you get first, the AstraZeneca or the Pfizer, different waiting times for both. I'm just looking at the numbers for Tokyo, actually, just changed tack slightly, 614 new cases on Sunday. So that's where they are at the moment. Right, a little bit closer to home, slightly cheerier. I think like we've brought the tone down. Eid holidays.
Yeah, so we have Eid al-Adha holidays have been announced for both the public and private sector. They are the same, running from Monday, July 19th to Thursday, July 22nd.
So that's basically Monday to Sunday next week.
Yeah, right? Like everybody's back on Sunday the 25th.
Is that next Monday it starts?
Yes. Hmm. Yep. So literally everybody's in for one day and then off you go, unless you put in for that day off as well. I don't know. Just.
You put that one out there?
No,
already?
No, I'm in. I'm working.
Have you already put your hand up for the Sunday, have you?
I'm in. I'm working. If you guys aren't here, then I don't
You're
know.
You're talking to yourself.
It is quite a long one, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. Is it, in counting the weekend, like Brandy was saying earlier. Yeah. It's a nice stretch for, I think, duly needed for a lot of people right now. I mean, I think that's always been a consensus, something that's always been said. You know, it's like everybody wanting, instead of a duvet day, taking a mental health day. So this will be a good week.
Could do with one of those today.
I know, Tom. I'm sorry.
Actually, I could just do with a duvet.
I bought you pies.
Yeah, exactly.
You did, and you've been a gem, and both Brandy and I have been devouring them.
I'll try and source you a duvet, shall I?
Poor old Reen. She was up all night baking pies for us. And they are delicious.
Oh,
so thank you very much indeed.
You're so welcome.
But if there is, if there are any duvets out there, just send one in. I will quite happily have a little ziz here.
That's
in the
niche in the market, isn't it? Delivery companies delivering duvets. They deliver everything else.
Deliver a duve.
Delivery duve. He's marketed it now as well. Copyright.
Duvery. Yeah. Duvery. I can't even do that.
Deliveroo.
Business breakfast copyright right there.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Very pleased to be joined on the line to talk to us about what is happening with travel trends over Eid and beyond with the General Manager for the UAE Leisure at Danata, Emily Jenkins. Emily, lovely to speak to you again. Good morning.
Good morning, Brandy. How are you?
I'm good. Let's start with the UK. where the British did get some of the changes they hoped for over the weekend, being able to travel to amber list countries without quarantining on return. But it does seem at the moment that that only applies to those whose double jabbed vaccinations are registered on the NHS app. There's talk of that changing, but for the moment it could rule out expats. What does that mean for summer travel?
So the announcement that vaccinated residents of the UK would be able to travel from amber list countries without the need to quarantine on return to England was really positive news. However, as you said, at this stage, the provision which goes into action, I believe, on the 19th of July only covers those travellers fully vaccinated by the NHS in Britain. We are expecting more news for expat Brits. And as soon as we update, obviously, we will ensure our customers know the same about that. But we are still seeing, in terms of Eid and the summer travel trends, that there are a lot of customers still trying to travel back via an amber list country for that 11-night stay en route back to the UK.
Which amber list countries are proving the most popular for that?
So Italy, Spain, obviously parts of Spain as well are on the green list at the moment as well. We are also seeing Switzerland, Greece, lots of people going back via the USA as well. So, yeah, it's a real mixed bag at the moment.
Are you expecting to see a spike if the vaccine registration NHS app situation changes?
Yes, absolutely. So we're at the moment, in terms of our call volumes, we are finding, because of, you know, all of the constant change and regulations and rules and people trying to get clarity, we've seen a large spike in customers calling us or coming in to visit us in store to try and find out what's happening. And we are getting a lot of inquiries for, you know, if this does happen, you know, will there be availability on a flight for me to be able to go? I also do think, obviously, there are a lot of people asking about having family members come out to visit them as well. So I think it's people just trying to understand which is the best option for them at the moment.
Where are we in terms of availability for summer travel? I know that the last time we spoke, you said a lot of people were leaving it to the last minute. Are people in danger of missing out of the travel that they want? I mean, I'm looking again at that Freedom Day movement coming out of the UK. There's going to be a huge amount of pent-up demand for travel.
Yeah, so interestingly, the UAE remains for us the number one travel destination of choice. So in terms of, staycations and customers wanting to stay here over the summer. However, for Eid al-Adha specifically, we've seen about an 81% of overall search traffic is for international destinations. I think also there's a lot of the airlines aren't flying with the same regularity that they used to. So once an airline might fly multiple times a day to a destination, they may now only be flying four or five times a week. So that is also having an impact. Obviously, around Eid specifically, there will be peaks, you know, the weekend before and after. But we are seeing that people are using this extended Eid break as an add-on to their longer summer holidays, where they're going away for, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks.
Right. So going away for Eid, but not necessarily coming back.
Yes.
What are we likely to see happen to prices, particularly for some of those amber list countries? Or what are we already seeing happen? I'm not looking so much at flights at the moment. I'm looking at hotels.
Sure. So we have, for some destinations, I think more so some of the green list destinations, we did see, you know, once an announcement is made that pricing does generally and availability move quite quickly upwards. The islands, the Balearic Islands in Spain is a great example. But I think still at the end of the day, as I said earlier, we are seeing a lot of people choosing not to travel overseas. There is still a lot of options available. And, you know, every week over the last few months, we've had more and more European destinations open up. So I do believe there's enough choice there for people to be able to find, you know, different options based on what their budget is.
What do we know about the people who aren't travelling? What conversations are you having with people? Is it fear of the virus itself? Is it concern about being stuck somewhere? Lack of clarity around the rules?
I think it's all of the above. But I think the biggest one that the biggest barrier or pushback we're seeing for people travelling overseas is purely around the rules changing and confusion around rules. So people, you know, not being sure if they, you know, travel to a particular country, if the changes, if there is going to be a change while they're there. But also some destinations which are open for international tourists to enter have more complex rules in place in destination, and not all countries accept the same vaccines for entry, for example. So I think there's a lot of confusion around that. At the start of the pandemic, we had set up a dedicated team at Dunata Travel to monitor all of these daily changing rules and regulations to be able to communicate effectively with our team and customers. However, you know, as you know, things are changing so regularly. I think people are a bit nervous about being stuck overseas. We have also seen, which has been quite interesting, a really big upswing in travel insurance purchases in the last fortnight. Particularly the policy that we sell covers travellers for COVID-19. So, for example, it has an enhanced COVID-19 coverage for things such as medical or quarantine expenses in destination, but also cancellation and amendments if you contract COVID before travelling. So I think that obviously is also a concern for people as well of, you know, what will happen if I do contract COVID whilst I'm travelling or before I'm travelling. So all of these factors are having an impact on whether or not customers are choosing to stay here or go away.
Which is interesting because all of the airlines coming out of the UAE have now announced their own travel insurance. And we were speculating at the time whether or not that would stop people from buying extra insurance, but you're saying they still are.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the insurance policy that we have is fully comprehensive. So it doesn't just cover you for COVID. It's also covering, you know, lost luggage or other medical expenses. So we are seeing a lot of people are still purchasing that as well, just looking for, I think, any kind of reassurance and safety that they can, that their travel plans will go ahead.
40 seconds left with you. Talk to us about Asia. We're seeing more restrictions in Malaysia, South Korea, a curfew in Bangkok. What impact is that having on Asian holiday plans? Are you seeing cancellations?
Yes, to be honest, we haven't seen a huge amount of Asian holiday bookings anyway. Phuket has had a bit of a spike. Normally at this time of year, we would see people travelling home for the holidays, so, you know, Philippines, India, etc. But due to the border restrictions, we haven't seen this. We didn't have a huge amount of bookings in the first place for Asia for us to be experiencing a large amount of cancellations anyway.
And before we let you go, two or three top tips. Where are people actually searching for and booking the Seed?
So the Maldives is still number one. I think people are really, you know, loving how clear and easy it is to get in there. Tanzania, but then very much Turkey, Greece, Switzerland, Cyprus and Italy.
Emily Jenkins is the UAE General Manager of Leisure at Dunata Travel, speaking to us this morning about what the Eid trends are just after the government has announced the holidays for the public and private sectors, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and the weekend.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
After the announcement of an especially long Eid, we are looking at travel this morning. That is our special focus. Eid into summer. We are very pleased to be joined to give us an international outlook now. Nicholas Mayer is the Global Industry Leader of Tourism and Hospitality at PwC. Nicholas, good morning. Thanks for speaking to us.
Morning, Brandy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's kick off having a look at what we are seeing at the moment when it comes to Asia. We've been talking in our headlines about the spike in cases the increased restrictions that we are seeing in a number of Asian countries. Malaysia in lockdown. We have the highest cases in Australia in a year. Japan declaring a state of emergency. What does this mean for the nascent recovery of the travel sector?
First of all, it's first and foremost, of course, a national tragedy for these countries if they are going back into lockdowns and into spikes, and we wish them well. From a tourism perspective, what it means for an Asian country or any other country, as soon as there is a relatively unexpected or short-term lockdown, that, of course, you know, rattles people's trust a little bit in how they plan their summer vacation. So what you'd probably see from this is that indeed quite a few people out of the region here from elsewhere are maybe going to postpone their commitment to travel to these regions a little bit longer. Maybe also going to say, well, if it's a lockdown now, maybe I'm also not going to go in August and September. So it slows down again, basically, the tourism ramp up, which many of these economies in Malaysia, Thailand and so on, of course, is super, super important. So it's not a good thing. And I hope to come out of it as quick as possible.
How is the travel and tourism industry doing at the moment? If we were to sort of chart where we are in terms of, I use the word recovery, but I also use the word nascent. Where are we?
We are not where we used to be, but much better than where we have been. So we are seeing the first signs of, I would say, a ramp up that pretty much spreads itself globally with both the providers of traveling, but also with the tourists themselves, increasingly looking for matching pairs of saying, where am I? Where can I go? And if you look at what's happening inbound or outbound, increasingly people are now comfortable and have the level of trust to basically say, fine, I will go to Italy, to Europe, to wherever I believe that I can get in there and basically spend my time on tourism rather than quarantine. So we're on the way picking up, but it's still a long way to go.
How long can airlines, though, sustain this uncertainty in these lower numbers? I mean, chatting to some Australian friends over the last couple of days, we've got, you know, planes landing in Australia either empty or with caps of less than 30 people on them. Airlines aren't charity. How long can they do that?
Well, I think different airlines probably came into this crisis, for lack of a better word, with different balance sheets, and that's probably going to determine how they're going to come out. I don't know about individual airlines, but it's clear that I think you've had plenty of people also on your show that have made this clear. They are indeed not charities. They are trying to ramp up as quick as possible. And I would say if they've made it so far, probably the outlook is much better than it was 3 months ago.
So where is your outlook for Eid at the moment? We've had the announcement of 4 days off work for a lot of people. Tag that on to the weekend, and that's almost a week's stay. What are you expecting to see?
I think, first of all, that is kind of the cornerstone of what many people make a longer 2 or 3 week vacation in order to combine their annual leave with this. So you're seeing a quite cool mix. So you're seeing people going abroad, obviously, where that's possible. I think Italy is a super interesting one because that's where the COVID-free flights, for example, have already basically been established and seem to be working really well. And many other people, of course, are choosing also to stay here, either because they say, well, I haven't found a spot abroad where I want to go, or because they simply have discovered over the last 12 months that there's actually a lot of cool things to do here in Dubai, which I think we always knew. But, I mean, the whole tourism scene here in the Emirate and in the Emirates as well has really, you know, upped its game, and there's a lot of cool things to do. So I think it's a mix, and a lot of people combine it to say, well, maybe I'll do a slightly shorter vacation somewhere else, but I'm super happy to spend some of my extra vacation here locally and basically take advantage of the cool things that people came up with.
Are we not staycationed out?
I'm not. I think we are, on the contrary, actually. I think we've only just discovered over the last 12 months or 18 months that a staycation is actually something that is very desirable. Now, we're going to combine it. And if I look at my own summer plans, I want to have both. But I think we're not staycationed out. On the contrary, we're only just starting to bring in staycation as a viable option of saying, well, I've learned about this last 12 months by duress, for lack of a better word. And now I'm going to be making it part of my recurring vacation plans now and in fall and on the way forward.
What impact does the UK lifting quarantine for those travelling out of the UK into amber list countries have on supply, demand and prices and vacation spots this summer?
I'm not sure that that is specific to the UK, but I think it's specific to which basically is able and feels comfortable in allowing its citizens to travel abroad and other countries to let, you know, basically to welcome guests, right? So if we look at here at Dubai, luckily, we have an unbelievably diverse visitor base, right? I mean, there's few places in the world that welcome so many segments. So every country that basically makes travel easier immediately basically in visitation to Dubai, and to some extent, if it goes both ways, also some people go in there. So that would mean some more visitors. Whether it's going to be the big wave, I don't know, because I think when lockdowns or restrictions are eased, people tend to stay cautious for a while first, saying, let me see if this holds or how this plays out. Let me send others ahead to see how their experience was. But we will see some increase then. And as far as prices, I mean, look, I think you can look at it two ways. I think on one hand, there is still ample capacity right now, right? I mean, you know, hotels are not full to 100% and we're still not at the levels previous. So that should usually mean that there's some pretty good deals to be made. But at the same time, of course, with very cool offerings, you know, very cool offerings have a very cool, have a price tag to it. And I think what's also important for us all as consumers is, if we want the tourism sector to thrive and survive and to continue providing us with cool experiences, then perhaps this summer is not the summer where we want to squeeze our tourism sector to the absolute minimum in order to get another 50 dirhams savings in there. We got to remember that these entities basically need to get up again and make sure that we continue having cool holidays.
Nicholas Meyer is the global industry leader of tourism and hospitality at PwC, speaking to us about Eid holiday trends ahead of that, what will be a 6-day holiday for many people. And as both he and Emily Jenkins from Donata have said this morning, Emily looking at the booking rates coming out of Donata, a lot of people tagging that on to a longer holiday, taking advantage of those free days off work, if you like.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
One of our stories that we've been looking at this morning is, of course, Sir Richard Branson, who, well, just popped to space yesterday, as one does. He landed safely after completing his Virgin Galactic, not to be messed up and mistaken with Atlantic, the Virgin Galactic space flight. The British billionaire has pipped Jeff Bezos in the new billionaire's space race, but questions do loom over whether he will actually reach space. What constitutes space these days? And is it actually good for space? July is a frantic month for the two billionaires racing to kick off space tourism with Branson's Spaceship 2 set to launch or launching yesterday with the British entrepreneur on board just days ahead of his rival and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos in his rockets. Not just one rocket man, but a load of them as well. So what pressure does that put on space? What pressure does that put on the security in space? Some suggesting that the cybersecurity aspects of space travel and the threat that compromised infrastructure could pose to human exploration of space is increasing. In fact, it is upon us already. To discuss this further, we are joined by the senior security researcher at Kaspersky. It is Maher Yamut. Maher, good morning to you. Joining us live on the line and live on Microsoft Teams.
Good morning. Good morning.
So let's first and foremost get your thoughts on the billionaires' race for space at the moment. It seems that it's become the plaything of the ultra rich around the world. But it's also become a huge area of investment for organisations, for countries as well. Is space travel going to become the new norm, or is it already the new norm?
Absolutely, great question. I mean, it used to be in the past, like every government or superpower wants to be in space for monitoring and so on. But now you can see more and more we are hearing in the news. And as you mentioned, multi-billionaires and even international companies are pushing towards space nowadays. So it is already the new norm. We will be seeing it more and more. I mean, everyone is competing now, not only the governments, but also private sector. So that's interesting because it will bring everyone on board, especially when the success stories become even more nowadays.
So in the past, Maher, we used to sort of rely on our governments, and the governments would conduct our space exploration programs. In recent times, we've seen a lot more personal and individual investment. Is that going to be a problem moving forward, the government versus personal?
I mean, there's no competence over this, like per se, because obviously, government or the public sector rely on the private sector in many areas, and space will not be the first one. So I don't think there will be any issues as long as everyone is on board and on the same page.
So the next question is, and forgive me for it coming across as sounding simplistic, but is there enough space in space? By which I mean, if there are so many people going up there, surely there's enough space up there.
Well, our space is quite large. I mean, as long as they at least be within the same framework, operating framework, there should be space for everyone. I mean, there's no limit for space, obviously. And there's, you know, Mars exploration, and the moon exploration, even the surrounding of planet Earth is also interesting to explore and discover. So there's obviously a lot of space. The problem that I always see, like if they don't fall within the same framework of operating framework, you would see a lot of space junk, as the term suggests. It's something like the debris of rockets and other elements in space. That becomes an issue not only in space, and it causes also physical impact on space devices like the satellites, but also it can cause harm to us as well on Earth.
And is that what we call, or what you call, space infrastructure?
So space infrastructure is whatever comprises satellites. Even there are a lot of layers, at least three layers of satellites, like the low-level or low-orbit satellites, the mid-level satellites, and the high-level, high-orbit satellites. So all these comprises the space infrastructure, and whatever connects those devices to planet Earth is also part of that infrastructure.
So in your opinion, professional opinion, what needs to be done to protect the increasing number of assets in space at the moment?
So, I mean, there's a lot of investments in these areas, right? So, and the problem with these investments, I think, and it's not only for space, but it used to be the case in the past as well, with any new domain coming in to operations, we deploy infrastructure, we deploy technology, but we forget about securing that technology. And hackers and threat actors would come in at some point and then exploit it just for competence, for competitive advantage, perhaps for collecting even information on the progress of these technologies and so on. So we are seeing always a demand in new domains, in new areas, just for us as humans to advance in our career path, if I want to say. And so it's always important to incorporate security from the beginning till the end.
Cybersecurity, obviously, major concern for us already, will be moving forward as well. Is there an argument that we can sort of learn from our mistakes to protect ourselves further with cybersecurity moving forward?
Well, I hope so. I hope so that everyone will do learn from previous mistakes in other domains. And we have seen also, like in even the recent years, some cyber threats or cyber attacks targeting and affecting these space infrastructure, even from the high orbit satellites till the ground level, if you want, and the user segment. Even it affected the communication medium between those two segments. So I hope we do learn, and this is probably a call for awareness call, if you want, so we can incorporate security at the beginning, because it did happen in the past and it did happen for space infrastructure in the recent years.
Space, the final frontier. It is a land of opportunity. Maha, really appreciate your time this morning. Maha Yamut is the senior security researcher at Kaspersky. Talk to us about the risks of cybersecurity here on Earth, given the increase in space travel and the pressure on, or the threat to, that, as he called it, space infrastructure, the mission control or mission critical systems such as rockets, orbital stations, satellites, unmanned air systems, space probes, robotics. I could go on, but then again, we haven't got enough time.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.